meeting is now being recorded.
Hello and welcome to the CCWG Accountability Workstream 2 Jurisdiction Subgroup Meeting number 36 on June 20th, 2017 at 1900 UTC. Let me remind everyone to mute when they are not speaking. So let us review the agenda. First, we'll have our minute or two of administration, followed by a couple of minutes of review of the decisions and actions from the last call, and then into the body of the call, where we'll take a look for the first time at the list of proposed issues, followed by reports on questionnaire response, and also review of ICANN litigation. I see that we do have Raphael Beauregard-Lacroix on the call, so we should be able to cover the cases that he summarized, thankfully. I don't know that we have David McCauley, and I'm here as well, so we'll be able to cover at least those three cases, assuming time permits. Then we'll have AOB and adjournment. And the next time we will all see each other, be together to some extent, will be the plenary in Johannesburg. So let us go back to the – any comments on the agenda before we move on? Seeing none, I'll move back to going through the agenda. First, changes to SOIs. Does anybody have a change to their statement of interest? No other changes to statements of interest. I have a change to my statement of interest. I have joined a new law firm. Hopefully you'll not hear me say that again. Now a partner at the Bortstein Legal Group, technology specialty law firm with locations in New York and London. So that is one change to an SOI that needs to be noted. Do we have any audio-only participants? It seems we do not, and I don't see any phone number only participants in the attendance list in Adobe, so we seem to be in good shape there. So let's move on to item four in the agenda. And in case you weren't reading the list today, as I noted in a response to an email from Benedicto, this item here is not an invitation to discuss what we've discussed on the last two calls. It is the decision section here is intended just to report decisions from prior call for purposes of continuity and information. Since the matter discussed there, and indeed the last sentence says, this will be taken up at the CCWG plenary face-to-face. Since this is now a matter before the plenary and not a matter before this subgroup, I'm not expecting that we'll have a discussion on this particular point, but I will read out the summary of what was decided at the last call. Thomas Rickert, speaking for the CCWG co-chairs, reminded the subgroup of the method used in Workstream 1 of narrowing alternatives at difficult junctions by focusing on the option that had the most traction. Applying this method, the co-chairs concluded that the subgroup will take California jurisdiction, i.e. law, place of incorporation, and headquarters location, as a baseline for all recommendations and will work on solutions founded on this. The subgroup will not pursue recommendations to change ICANN's jurisdiction of incorporation or headquarters location or seek immunity for ICANN, recognizing there is no possibility of consensus for an immunity-based concept or a change of place of incorporation. This does not eliminate any issues. The subgroup can discuss all issues that might arise during deliberations. This will be taken up at the CCWG plenary face-to-face at ICANN 59. Tiago, your hand is up, but do be brief since this is not intended to reopen this discussion, which will take place at the plenary.
Thank you, Greg. Now I'm going to be brief. I do understand that the issue will be taken to the CCWG plenary, as you said, and at that point I will make sure to state the views of Brazil. Now, if you allow me, I would just like to share one or two ideas for the record, for clarity. I hope some might eventually carry with them to the plenary meeting. So last week, during our online meeting, supposedly a decision was taken, but then it became apparent, and I think it is clear now, that after a number of emails exchanged in our mailing list, that a decision was not taken. Instead, a decision was imposed on us, as I understand it. As you can read in the agenda, which is in front of you, and I will use the wording of the decision, the co-chairs from the CCWG concluded that the group will not pursue certain recommendations. Now, the way the decision is presented sounds to me like a belated confession of guilt. I noticed that many people reacted to the announcement last week that the subgroup had adopted a proposal by the CCWG co-chair. Many expressed that they did not support it, and also that they would be interested in better discussing the proposal. But then I ask, what was done with their views? What was done, for example, to my request that the co-chair's proposal be subjected to the scrutiny of the subgroup in a transparent way and with clear deadlines for reactions? It seems to me that the only consequence of the lack of support for the co-chair's proposal, as expressed in the mailing list in particular, was the admission now that the decision was imposed upon the subgroup from above. Now, let me reproduce what others have been saying about this. Without a prior authorization from the CCWG plenary, and I stress prior authorization, without a prior authorization, the co-chairs do not have the authority to interfere with the work of the subgroup. This is one point. The second and very brief point is on the substance of the co-chair's proposal. Among other things, it says that the subgroup will not seek immunity for ICANN because there is no consensus to change ICANN's place of incorporation. In other words, as the argument goes, because ICANN will not change its place of incorporation, so the subgroup will not seek immunity for ICANN. Now, I don't know where this idea came from, and I said this before, but this is simply wrong. There is no correlation between the assumption that ICANN will remain incorporated in California and the conclusion that, as a consequence, all forms of immunity are off the table. Also, there is no consensus within subgroup that the immunity avenue is entirely out of question, and it is certainly not for the co-chair to substitute his views for the views of the subgroup. Thank you.
Tiago, I'll let Thomas Rickard, who is on the call, respond with regard to the issues you raised regarding the co-chair's decision. I will say that I disagree with your retelling of history and find it to be inconsistent with my recollections and with the facts that I've seen. I did, at the end of the call last week, seek opposition to the co-chair's proposal. We noted four in opposition, although you left. I noted you as being in opposition since your views were clear before you left. Really the same four people plus one other and an associate of one other, of one of the four who've expressed views, maybe two others. So there's not a groundswell of disapproval of the co-chair's decision, quite the opposite. I believe that we stand on a firm footing with regard to the group's views on this. I do understand it is not unanimous and that is not required. Just one last point. There's not, in fact, a statement that the immunity is taken off the table as a consequence of the discussion, decision to take jurisdiction and place incorporation off the table. It is a related decision in that, but it is not a consequence. So that is not really at issue here. In any case, I'll turn to Thomas to respond, hopefully, briefly. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Greg, and hello, everyone. This is Thomas Beckett speaking. I will not go into detail, although Tiago's statement would really require some detailed response. I think it's perfectly okay for Tiago to present the views of his government on this subject, and that will certainly be conveyed, and it's on record now for everyone to read. But I will leave it to the group to go to the transcripts of the last two meetings where I explained in detail how the co-chairs came to the conclusion that we now see summarized in the Adobe room in front of us. And I'm sure that you will probably agree with me that that one can argue whether Tiago's summary was an accurate reflection of what was actually said. I would suggest that we follow Greg's recommendation for today's meeting and not reopen the debate on this very topic. As indicated on the list, we do plan to explain this to the CCWG plenary when we convene in Johannesburg, and I think that neither would I be in a position to change Tiago's and others' view, and it is not my intention to do so, but it would also be a duplication of efforts if we went through it again today and then in Johannesburg. But rest assured that we will explain what we did for the benefit of the whole CCWG, and let me also refresh your memory that whenever we took decisions such as this, we always, as we did in this case, opened the opportunity to file minority statements, and therefore the whole global community will have the opportunity to review what has been discussed, what views, what positions were taken, and then inform the CCWG on how to deal with this in its final report. So I think I should pause here. Thanks, Greg, for letting me speak in this meeting again. And I will now let you turn your attention to the substantive work. Thank you.
Thank you, Thomas. Tiago, I'll assume that's an old hand, and we'll move on to the next point. Just a warning, I'm running this off a tablet, which does not show the captioning. Because that is an unsupported content in the tablet version of Adobe Connect and does not queue up hands. Such is life. Can't get the Adobe Connect installer passed to the administrator privileges on my office computer, new office computer. Anyway, let's not go further in this because we could obviously discuss this forever as we have for two meetings and perhaps for 10 months as well. Let us move to the list of proposed issues. I don't know, I did not ask staff to download the list and put it up, but I checked it just before the meeting and it's blank. But that's not entirely surprising. I did not create this document until last Friday, and obviously Friday before the week before a meeting is not an ideal time to start a cataloging project or any project. So I'm hopeful that we will be able to crowdsource this work to our group. Jorge Concio asked on the list, and he offers his apologies for not being on the call, but Jorge asked on the list whether this is something staff could do. So I will consult with staff and see if all or any part of the job of kind of transporting or migrating issues, potential issues from the various documents that we have and discussions and the like to this master list can be helped by staff, and maybe there'll be some division of labor on that. So I invite each of you to go to the list, and if you have contributed to our work in any way, if you've raised any proposed issues or reviewed a litigation or reviewed a questionnaire response which proposed some issues, if you could add those to the list, just the first few columns at this point, which is just the sort of kind of a short title for the proposed issue, a description of the proposed issue. That I expect to be fairly lengthy, although since the document is empty, each row is only one line high, but I'm sure that will change. Submitted by, just a note of who is putting it into this list, and if it's has a first, and then and the date it's submitted, then the next is the source for the proposed issue. So if you're submitting it, but it's based on a questionnaire response from, say, the Internet Governance Project, you would put that there and add a link going back to their submission. Hopefully fairly simple, straightforward. In retrospect, as Sean noted in the list, it would have been nice if I had thought of doing this 10 months ago and we had kept cataloging as we went along. But if I were perfect, I would, I don't know what I would be, but I probably wouldn't be here. In any case, any questions or thoughts or comments on the list of proposed issues? I think it's fairly self-explanatory. I'm not seeing any hands. So we can move on. And I'll move to the first, well, we have only one this time, questionnaire response, the response of Mohammad Reza Mousavi, which was analyzed by Eric Schweighofer. So, Eric, if I could ask you to take the microphone and discuss and summarize this response for us, that would be very helpful. Thank you.
Greg, Eric Schweighofer is speaking. You see the response on the screen. It's a quite short response. It refers to question one and mentions that essential services in domain name and numbering are banned because of sanctions, particularly U.S. sanctions. And it claims that such conflicts affect domain name-related services, and ICANN should neutralize such conflicts. And concerning question 4A, mentions that registrars and canceled domain name registrants in Iran subject to U.S. sanctions, and also some registrars, both American and non-American, have stopped providing service to countries under sanctions of the OFAC, the Office of Foreign Assets Control. And then as a last item, mentions also the seizure of Iran's internet domains. There was a case before the District of Columbia and then also the Court of Appeal. And this court decided that the seizure is not possible due to a reasoning that third-party interests may be impaired. Mousavi doesn't present any documents, so maybe but you also can't read it. It's a statement, and it seems to be quite true that this is happening. From my analysis, it's a bit similar like the Russian cases, that there are sanction regimes by the United States, the European Union, plus the others. This here concerns in particular when this OFAC regime a financial action task force regime that's run by, under the umbrella of the OECD, and it covers most countries concerning money laundering and terrorism financing, and the various countries implement these rules. And that is the question, how I can track this kind of sanctions. When it comes to international law, I can should respect it, and it means also that sanction regimes should be followed, meaning that there will be some blocking under these rules. The problem is, if these sanctions are not followed by the whole community, only the particular states, territories, how do we act? And in my view, the Weinstein case shows that courts can react properly to that, giving something what we may call some kind of immunity, because it doesn't affect the particular party, it affects the whole internet community, and this comes close to what leaving ICANN alone under its particular legal regime, not affecting this regime by implementing sanctions against ICANN or its particular entities. So I mentioned also in the last word that some kind of a special organization and organizations sui generis, and states should leave ICANN alone, meaning accepting appropriate immunities, maybe not under this concept, maybe more under the third-party doctrine. Thank you.
Thank you, Eric. Does anybody have any questions or comments on this? I see Tiago has his hand up. Tiago, go ahead, please.
Thank you. So just to make sure I understand this case correctly, so what the decision means is not that U.S. jurisdiction or U.S. courts have no authority to determine, for example, a redelegation of a country code name. What the case means, and this is my understanding, is that in that particular case, U.S. judges decide to not exercise, decide in favor of plaintiffs because they exercised a discretion, they attempted to protect the interests of third parties. But at the same time, the decision does not mean that the U.S. courts in the future will act similarly. Is that correct to, for example, assume that the decision, on the contrary, is a reaffirmation of the possibility that if circumstances so require in the future, a U.S. judge will be in a position to decide that a country court top-level domain must be redelegated to another party, sort of expropriation. I suppose I wrote an email on this subject before, and I'm re-expressing those views that are already stated there. Thank you.
Tiago, as you're probably well aware, we're not actually discussing that case. That case was analyzed on our call some weeks ago. We're discussing the Mousavi response, so I don't think Eric is prepared to discuss the case. I don't know if we have the person on the call who briefed that case for the group. I read the case a while ago. My recollection of the holding of the case is quite different from yours. I believe the finding was that the .IR was not an asset and thus could not be attached. And what you call discretion, we call a court opinion, and that's what judges do. So I don't think it was an exercise of discretion. Rather, it was an exercise of the judge's authority, the thing that they exist to do. So I don't want us to get sidetracked onto a discussion of that case, especially since we're not – that's not what was on the agenda. In any case, that's my recollection. So I don't think trying to score points on that case is the point of the Mousavi discussion. So if you have any comments on the Mousavi comment, that would be great. Milton, I see your hand is up.
Yes, hello. Can you all hear me?
Are you loud and clear, Milton?
Okay. So the Mousavi comments indicate that the Iranians still feel a bit nervous about the status of their CCTLD, and I can't help but correct your statement. The court most emphatically did not decide that it was not an asset. Indeed, that was the subject of the rather long law review article that Farzana and I published. They decided that it could very well be an asset, but that they were unwilling to interfere with the ICAN regime by redelegating. In terms of Thiago's concern about whether this was discretionary, it might be useful in terms of responding to Mousavi's concerns as to whether that decision has, how much of a precedential value it has. I think it's not correct to say that it was purely discretionary and some other court could just come up with anything they liked. I think it does have some precedential value, particularly since it's an appeals court. And it's sort of setting a marker down in a fairly new area. But maybe some of the true lawyers here should comment on that.
Thank you, Milton. I suggest that if you want to have an extended discussion on this case, and, you know, it is a case, obviously, that has, you know, relation to the Internet Governance Project comment or questionnaire response as well as this one, that we should put that on the agenda so that people can be prepared to discuss the case. Obviously, Milton, since you wrote on it, it's etched in your brain, but for the rest of us, not so much. Thiago, briefly, please, and hopefully this is on the Mousavi comment.
Thank you, Greg. I'm only referring to that case, which was discussed in the past, apparently, because I saw, and I see in the document in front of us, the reference to that particular case. As you can see, there is this mention to Weinstein, Islamic Republic of Iran, and the problem, as Miller noted, is not that much different from the one currently under discussion. It concerns the consequences of OFAC sanctions. It concerns the possibility of U.S. judges on the basis of OFAC sanctions forcing redelegations of country code top-level domains. So I understand eventually we will come back to these discussions in the future, but it seems to me that it's also...
I lost Thiago.
Great time to. I'm not sure what was the last thing you heard of me saying, but I meant to say that it seems to me that this is still an appropriate time to raise such issues that are closely connected to the questionnaire under consideration. Thank you.
Eric, why don't you go ahead, please?
Thank you. Ash Weikhofer is speaking. I didn't read all details of this case, but my indication and my understanding was that the courts are at least reluctant to affect third-party interests and seize a country code top-level domain. The problem occurs in all courts worldwide. The United States is not the only country that has most assets and has most proceedings go on. Therefore, we should revisit the case again and see if this ruling may be used also by other courts. Thank you.
Thank you, Eric. I think that's a good point. We can come back to these points on another call, as well as if someone's going to spin out a theory that somehow OFAC can be used to redelegate top-level domains, which I find to be an unsupported theory, but we should not do it on this call because we have three litigations to review, and we're now at 35 after the hour. I'm not hearing Tiago. In any case, let's move along to item 7, a review of ICANN litigation. We have two litigations that Raphael Beauregard-Lacroix summarized. So if we could put the first one up, Board v. Banco de Chile, that would be helpful, and I'll turn the mic over to Raphael.
Thanks, Greg. So, Raphael, for the record. So let's start with Board versus Banco de Chile. So both of the cases that I'll be presenting now are not so important, I think, for as far as we're concerned now, because they also involve the relation of ICANN with the Department of Commerce, which is a relation that doesn't really exist any longer. But for the sake of the review, let's go through them. So Board versus A is basically the story of Eric Board, who registered the domain name bancodechile.com, which the Central Bank of Chile did not enjoy, obviously. They filed a UDRP against Eric Board. They got the domain name, the Banco de Chile, back. Now Eric Board was not very happy with it and tried basically sued both the Department of Commerce and the actual Central Bank of Chile in the U.S. District Court of Virginia. So now if we go to the document, so basically the parties, as I said, it's Eric Board and the Central Bank of Chile and the Department of Commerce, latter two as defendants. Eric Board is American, the Central Bank of Chile is Chilean, and the Department of Commerce is American. As I said, the court, Eastern District of Virginia, choice of law, there was no contract in this case because the basically Eric Board was suing the Department of Commerce on the basis of U.S. administrative law. But it's interesting to note that in this case, the Central Bank of Chile basically accepted the jurisdiction of the court. I don't know what would have happened if they would have refused, but anyway, they accepted. And obviously, in the case of the Department of Commerce, because they're a government agency, they were by default within the jurisdiction of the court. So again, law used to determine conflict of law. There was not applicable in this case. The substantive law is American law. It's a case that happened over 6 months between 2001 and 2002. Now, the only part which is relevant and which was filed by ICANN is the part which basically where Eric Board is suing the Department of Commerce. The part between him and the Central Bank of Chile is not covered and is not really relevant for us. So basically, he is arguing against the Department of Commerce that there was a legal wrong pursuant to government agency action, that there was an unlawful delegation to a private entity of the quote-unquote authority to make policy. Now, this is something that I believe people who have been there longer than me with ICANN, there's been a lot of debate on this part, and basically also requiring that there be an arbitration procedure without proper authorization. So if we look at the issue in general, it's a challenge of UDRP and also this whole idea about the fact that the Department of Commerce delegated policy authority without proper legislative authorization. There was no preliminary relief, and what he wanted basically was just an injunction against this delegation. Now, he just, the whole suit was basically thrown out, didn't get anything out of it. Now, if we look at the risk to our mandate, I mean, given that the IANA transition is over, my understanding is that it's not really relevant for us anymore. Now, obviously, had this court decided that the UDRP was an unlawful delegation of powers to ICANN, now that could have put the whole ICANN business into jeopardy. Now, that didn't happen, thankfully, I suppose. So yeah, the suit was dismissed on the basis of lack of standing, because on the basis of U.S. administrative law. So they use a three-pronged test, which I don't list in this case because it's a bit convoluted. And, Eric Borges just fails on all counts. So yeah, so that's all for this case. So I don't know, Greg, if you want me to go over the next one or if you prefer that if there's any question, we take them now.
Why don't we see now if there are any questions on this case before we move on to the next one. I don't see any hands, however, and I don't have any questions myself. So why don't we move on to the second case?
All right, so for the record, again, so Schreiber versus Dunedin. I'll just maybe wait for it to show up on the screen. I see that the agenda was listing Employ Media versus ICANN, but that was the previous case, so it's not that one. Yes, Schreiber versus Dunedin. So again, for those who have been longer around than me, I think this was a case that was mediatized, not necessarily for the good reasons, mostly because it was, as I've said, bordering a frivolous case. Basically, Graham Schreiber, who is Canadian, restaurant of LandCruise.com, apparently has a Canadian trademark on this name, figures out that there's someone in the UK who registered LandCruise.uk.com, is not really happy about it, decides to sue everyone basically involved. So I list all the defendants, Lauren Dunedin herself, so the woman who registered LandCruise.uk.com, the registry for .uk.com, the registry for .com, ICANN, the registrar, involved both for in both cases for .uk.com and for .com as well, so a lot of people involved. Defendant A and B, so basically Lauren Dunedin and Central Nick are British companies or persons, and all the rest are American. He is suing them as a pro se litigant, so again, if my understanding is correct, it's basically that he's representing himself, so no lawyer. There is a huge mass of documents in the case. It's rather complex because the way that he writes the whole case is extremely convoluted. I don't know why he writes it this way, but the way he's trying to make his point makes it very hard to understand what is his point, actually. Or like what kind of relief he wants in law, like get his point that he's not happy that someone registered LandCruise.uk.com, but that doesn't really necessarily make a law case on its own. So choice of law provision, the contract, I don't really know because it's not clear. There's possibly a lot of contracts involved, but it's not really relevant in this case. The law used to determine the conflict of law issues, again, it's not relevant. Substantive law governing the dispute, here we're talking about U.S. law. The case started in 2012, ended in 2015, basically when he filed a notice of appeal too late, then filed a writ of mandamus, which was denied, basically to have a proper hearing of his case. Despite the fact that he was late at filing, didn't work out, so yeah, he missed a lot of deadlines on that. So causes of action is again, as I say a bit later, it's not very clear, but basically he's alleging that there's both primary and contributory trademark infringement of his trademark, which is LandCruise Limited, Canadian company, Canadian trademark. But then the problem with this whole thing is that trademark is in Canada, then the main defendant in the UK, and he's also suing all these American parties, including ICANN and the department. Sorry, not the Department of Commerce, but ICANN and VeriSign. So, I mean, to cut it short, his case was thrown out on lack of, on failure to state a claim. So with the reason, I suppose, and the failure to or lack of subject matter jurisdiction, of course. Because basically the only way out with this would be to have convinced the court to apply the Lanham Act, which is there to protect trademarks extraterritorially, meaning that even if there's no proper U.S. trademark, if you satisfy a few criteria, for example, if the trademark is very important in the U.S. or these kind of things, you can still have your trademark protected in the U.S. even if it's not a proper U.S. trademark. Now, obviously, in this case, it's really not the case. The two companies were actually different. So all his claims were dismissed. Now I put the quote of the court there. Jurisdiction was contested. I put yes in the sense subject matter was contested because the court actually thrown out the whole case on the basis of lack of subject matter jurisdiction. Now the jurisdiction of the to adjudicate of the court was not contested in that sense. Relevance to the mandate of the working group, I mean, none to the extent, again, that this was, I mean, almost frivolous. I don't think that the guy himself had malicious intentions, but let's say that he probably didn't really know what he was doing. Impact, I mean, it had no impact on ICANN. Now, impact, if the case had been decided on the other way, it's hard to imagine that it would have been, but again, a little bit like for the Banco de Chile case, obviously, if ICANN can become liable for this kind of trademark infringement on the part of private parties, potentially, that would be a major issue for ICANN. Now, thankfully, and also I quoted the safe harbor of the Lanham Act, so basically ICANN currently falls in this safe harbor, meaning that it cannot be held liable except in the case when it contributes itself to the infringement of trademark. The court commented of merit, yes, it did, it threw the case out on this basis. So, so that's pretty much it for Schreiber versus Dunedin. Thank you.
Thank you, Raphael. Any questions or comments on the Schreiber case? Which was certainly probably a unique case in the annals of ICANN litigation. I see no comments on this case, so we'll move on to the third case on our list, which is one that I summarized, this Commercial Connect versus ICANN and the International Center for Dispute Resolution. This was a case and one of a few that took place relating to the new GTLD round and the purported rights of applicants from the 2000 round whose applications were not accepted at that time. So Commercial Connect had applied for the .shop TLD back in 2000. It was not approved or disapproved at that time. It was not delegated, obviously. And they were told they could have, it would be considered the next round. In fact, they were given the opportunity to apply in the 2012 round for .shop and given a discount. I believe $86,000 refund, which required Commercial Connect to sign a release of claims against ICANN. They applied as a community application but did not get community status. CC made a number of claims that ICANN had retained unqualified evaluators who failed to apply objective criteria in the community application. They filed cases against every other .shop applicant, I believe, and they claimed that the applicant guidebook had false and misleading statements and that they were induced by those to apply in reliance on those claims. And those claims were set forth in the complaint, which, oddly enough, was never formally served on ICAM. The case actually involves more than the fact. It involves some jurisdictional dueling, if you will. Commercial Connect chose to bring the case in the state of Kentucky, in the federal court in the Western District of Kentucky, basically because that's where the plaintiff is, and they argued that this was proper venue because a substantial part of the events or omissions giving rise to the claim occurred there, and at all relevant times the plaintiff conducted business and interacted with ICAM and ICVR from Louisville, Kentucky. Basically, ICC had also filed a TRO, which also was not served, and also demanded preliminary or permanent injunction, basically to stop Dot Shop from being delegated, requested these damages as well. The their motion for an injunction was denied, and the at some point in this proceeding, their counsel withdrew because the CC was no longer listening to the advice of the lawyer. CC was given 30 days to find a new lawyer, which they didn't, and the corporation cannot be represented pro se by a non-lawyer in federal court. So ICANN request that the case be dismissed, both because they never filed the papers on ICANN and because they had no lawyer representing them. And the court issued a show cause order why the case should not be dismissed, and CC failed to respond to the order, didn't have a new lawyer either. ICANN made a special appearance, an appearance that preserved their argument that the court did not have jurisdiction over ICANN, filed a document in support of the dismissal, and the same day the court dismissed the case, although the dismissal was without prejudice, which means that the plaintiff could have refiled the case should it have choose to do so, but it has not chosen to do so. There was contested jurisdiction in this case, which I described at great length, arguing that ICANN and ICVR were under the personal jurisdiction of the court in Kentucky based on minimum contact and on effective defendant's conduct in the forum. ICANN opposed this jurisdiction, noting it had no facilities, assets, et cetera, in Kentucky, and they just have no transact business into Kentucky, that they have informational websites that can be viewed from Kentucky and everywhere in the world unless they're blocked. And none of them are, in fact, hosted on servers in Kentucky, so there's really nothing there, I can but argue, for jurisdiction to be based on. So for personal jurisdiction to exist in a diversity case, there need to be two factors satisfied, both the forum state long-arm statute and constitutional due process. That was I can't argue that there's no subsection of the Kentucky long-arm statute that applies to its particular situation. For instance, it does not transact any business in Kentucky or engage in any other persistent course of conduct in Kentucky. And ICANN showed a number of cases that merely entering into a contract with a Kentucky company does not alone support long-arm jurisdiction over a non-resident. In particular, no negotiations took place in Kentucky. And there's no subject matter connection to Kentucky. The websites don't offer any help either. So also argued that I can't argue that the court's jurisdiction did not meet the constitutional due process. That argument that ICANN had minimal contacts with Kentucky such that maintenance of the suit does not offend traditional notions of fair play and substantial justice. ICANN demonstrated that the court did not have general jurisdiction over ICANN, which would require continuous and systematic contact with Kentucky. And also, they demonstrated, or sought to demonstrate, and the court found that they did demonstrate, that the court lacked specific jurisdiction over ICANN, which would arise if ICANN activities in Kentucky took place that were related to the cause of action in the complaint. They found that ICANN didn't purposely avail themselves of the privilege of acting in Kentucky, nor did they take any activities in the state which would be required, and nor were their acts or consequences have a substantial enough connection to make jurisdiction reasonable. It's also, should be noted that the court's decisions relied on the failure to meet the preliminary injunction standard as well, and that was due largely to the releases that ICANN put into the new GTLD application, and therefore found that there was not a likelihood of success on the merits on the part of CC either. So the relevance of this case to our group is that it demonstrates that a court can find that it does not have personal jurisdiction over ICANN, or ICANN does not have any operations in that state and doesn't otherwise satisfy the long-arm statute and due process clause. So I would say that this case protected the operations of ICANN's policy. Demonstrates that ICANN, can be sued some places and not others. So that's enough on that case. Are there any questions or comments on the Commercial Connect case? I don't see any there. I don't believe we have David McCauley, or we do have David. I don't know if you want to try to do economic solutions in 2 minutes, or if we should save that for post-ICANN 59.
Greg, I can give it a pretty quick run if you want.
Go ahead.
Okay, thanks. David McCauley here for the record. This case is called Economic Solutions versus ICANN. It's one of the very early cases on the ICANN litigation page. And as a consequence, it's before they sort of organized how they're going to report these cases. There's only two documents, a statement by the then ICANN General Counsel about certain things and a court order denying a request for temporary restraining order. The nature of the case was unfair competition, trademark kind of case. Economic Solutions had been engaged by the government of Belize to commercialize the .bz CCTLD, and they were bringing suit to try and prevent ICANN from delegating .biz and .ebiz prospectively, trying to protect Belize's competitive position. Not everything about the case can be seen in the documents, but the issue of interest to our group, I'm sort of truncating what I wrote, to our group is that there was a question of whether ICANN was subject to jurisdiction in a federal court in the United States in the Eastern District of Missouri, where presumably ESI was located. And so the document of the then General Counsel, Louis Tutin, I think his name, I probably mangled the pronunciation, basically made the case that ICANN wasn't subject jurisdiction there for these reasons. ICANN had no assets in the state, didn't solicit business there, did not sell goods or services in Missouri, did not have a bank account in Missouri. No one had traveled to Missouri. No one had met personally with any of the plaintiff's representatives, et cetera, et cetera. Well, those are sort of ancient facts. Today, ICANN staff travel everywhere in the world and have contacts. So this is its relevance, I think, is attenuated, but it's an interesting statement, and the court denied the request for a temporary restraining order by ESI, and in so doing, it said that they probably not made enough of a showing for jurisdiction And one other thing of relevance, they said there's probably no showing of imminent harm because ICANN had mentioned that they didn't delegate TLDs. They simply made recommendations to the Department of Commerce, and we all know that that condition no longer exists. So I think it's attenuated, but jurisdiction was contested. And if we want more, I can go to it on another call. But in a nutshell, that's what happened in this case. Thanks, Greg. That's the end of my comments for now.
Thank you, David. Very concise. Any questions for David? I see none. I would ask David if you think there's anything in that case that rises to the level of a proposed issue for us to consider that you added to the issues list. I'm not sure that there is one.
Greg, no, I don't think so, no, but let me think about it. I hadn't thought about it in terms of in the context of the issues list, so I'll do that between now and the face-to-face meeting, but I think the answer will probably be no. Thanks.
Thank you, David. That takes us to the top of the hour. Let me ask briefly if there's any truly pressing AOB. I don't see anyone with AOB. I have no AOB other than to note that we'll be getting back together again, not in this subgroup, but in the CCWG plenary, in person and or remotely at ICANN 59 in Johannesburg. So I'll wish, Tiago, is that a new hand?
Yes, that's a new hand. If I may suggest something.
Throughout the discussion, for example, we've raised a couple of questions that are of interest to the person raising those issues. I raised the concerns related to the possibility of U.S. judges forcing redelegation of country code top-level domains. This emerged as we were discussing the questionnaire. So what I think we could do, and you particularly as rapporteur, is to take note of those issues that are being raised and put that on the list, and then we may eventually come back to those questions.
Tiago, if I could ask you to add that to the Google spreadsheet as a proposed issue, that would be much appreciated. Thank you. In any case, I will wish you all safe travels to Johannesburg. Those who are not traveling, I wish you not a too terrible a time zone for remote participation, and look forward to our next meeting, and this meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Greg. Thank you, everyone. Bye.
Thanks, Greg. Thank you, everyone. Bye.